This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist Network News.
It's December 23rd. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production of the American Humanist Association. And I'm your host, Jenda Huang.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We are podcasting from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition studio in Albany, New York.
December 23rd. I think something's happening today.
Yeah,
I don't
what
remember.
Is December 23rd?
It's human light. Yes. Happy human light, Jess.
And happy human light to you, Jenda.
And I think it's not only human light today, but it's also happy solstice.
That's correct.
Happy Hanukkah.
That's correct.
Happy Kwanzaa.
That's correct.
Happy Festivus.
That's correct.
Merry Christmas.
Yep.
And I think the Islamic New Year happened earlier this month too.
Wow. December is chock full of special days.
Seven holidays, I count right there.
If I may add an eighth, it is my birthday on December 29th.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Thank you. I think it should be a humanist holiday.
I think that's probably the most important one. Absolutely. Out of every holiday that had just been listed.
Absolutely.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So, Jess, I think the general consensus is you can be a good humanist and still celebrate any and all of these holidays.
I agree with that consensus, Jenda. So, listeners, whatever holiday you are choosing to celebrate, enjoy your health, enjoy your family, enjoy the weather, and just enjoy. Have fun.
Have a great day, hopefully.
Absolutely.
So now, after yes. the gifts have been opened,
yes,
after you've eaten your fill of food, and after you've gotten sick of your family members and secretly wished that they went home, we here at Humanist Network News have the perfect antidote for you, the listener. We have a great interview today with Greg Epstein, the humanist chaplain at Harvard University.
That's right. Greg Epstein serves as the humanist chaplain at Harvard University and sits on the executive committee of the 36-member core of Harvard chaplains. He holds a bachelor's degree in religion and Chinese and a master's in Judaic studies from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and also a master's of theological studies from the Harvard Divinity School. In 2005, Greg was ordained as a humanist rabbi from the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism, where he studied in Jerusalem and Michigan for 5 years.
And I was able to catch up with Greg earlier this month and talk to him about his new book. He has a new book out for those who have not heard. It is called Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe.
So here's that interview clip with Jenda and Greg.
All right, Greg, thanks for being on the show with us today.
My pleasure.
So what is your book about? What is Good Without God about?
Good Without God is a book about humanism. That's really the beginning and the end of what the book is about. It's the idea that humanism is what I think unites and can unite the world's 1 billion non-religious people, the 40 or 50 million non-religious Americans, the one in every four or five young Americans age 18 to 25 who describe themselves as non-religious. It's a book about what those people have in common, what they might have in common if they were to really give some thought to what their deepest beliefs and values are, and that's humanism. I mean, call it what you like. People use different names for it. I believe the best name for it is humanism.
So is your book a reaction to the New Atheists? I mean, would you have kept everything the same if the New Atheists, you know, Dawkins and Hitchens, if they hadn't come out with their books and kind of created all this media controversy? Would everything in your book have been the same, or do you think it would have been different?
I think the book pretty much stands on its own. It's not a reaction to those authors. I acknowledge the work that they've done. I acknowledge their contribution, which in many cases is really significant. And so, in that way, it's affected by their work. And it's also, it's certain parts of the book, I do respond to some of the things that I think may be incomplete or maybe worth revisiting in their books. But mainly, I really felt like it was a book about humanism, and it was time to write a book about humanism. And the way that the book came about was I was a student at Harvard Divinity School a few years ago, and I was taking a class with the religious scholar Diana Eck, who is one of the leading scholars in the world on what she calls and what others call religious pluralism, the idea that we can, you know, appreciate our own religion and believe in our own religion, but also, you know, affirm the dignity and the worth and et cetera of others. And we were reading sort of religious pluralistic texts from Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, et cetera. Authors that affirm those religious traditions, but basically have a lot to say that reaches out to others as well and is interested in the welfare of all people. And I said to Diana, well, this is all fine and good, but where's the book about humanism for this course? I mean, there's a billion non-religious people. You can't have a course like this without acknowledging them too. And at that point, she said, you know what? We really do need a new book for that subject. Why don't you get started writing it? I'll help you work on the proposal. At that point, I really all I had in mind was my final paper. But then I realized that we really did need a new book that would talk about humanism from that perspective for this generation.
I know you've recently been doing a book tour. You've gone to cities like Chicago, New York City, Tulsa, Silicon Valley, and Portland. Can you tell us like some of your stories from there? What are the reactions that you're getting from people when you go out and talk about your book and present these ideas?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to do that. And the reactions have been fantastic. And the interesting thing about it is that I've spoken to such diverse audiences that the reactions have been very different. And of course, you know, you can't please everybody because I'm speaking to a range of people, from those who would consider themselves, let's say, religious humanists, the people who see themselves as you know, having that title and joining congregations and communities that espouse humanism, to people who consider themselves secular humanists or atheists who are very much supportive of a humanist point of view but have no interest in joining a community or a congregation or anything like that. But I've also been speaking to a real diversity of religious people. I've been speaking at interfaith events, at churches and synagogues. And so, as you can imagine, their reactions are just really different. I remember at one point I was in Chicago, and I was speaking, doing a sort of keynote panel for a conference put on by an organization called the Interfaith Youth Corps, which is an interfaith organization. There were about 500 or 600 young interfaith leaders there from every religious tradition, including about 20% of the students would describe themselves there as non-religious. And I'm up there giving a panel, and I'm alongside a young rabbi with a beard and a black suit and a black yarmulke, and an Orthodox Muslim woman with the head covering that makes her very obviously Orthodox Muslim, an evangelical Christian, and a young woman Buddhist leader. And we're going around and we're talking about sort of what makes each of us tick, what our basic values are based on, and what we think of as that which motivates us to live a good life. And the Orthodox Muslim woman was answering. And then it came my turn to answer. I was sitting right next to her, and she turned to me and she said, in front of the audience, she said, I honestly don't know what you're going to say. And I gave my answer. And afterwards, you know, I think people were feeling pretty good about the good without God, the humanist answer. And she said, well, I never realized how much common humanity we have. I've never really understood what humanism was all about. And it underscored for me how misunderstood we humanists are and how much progress we can make if we simply tell our story to the world at large. And we'll never convince everybody, but she came away from just a few minutes of talking to me with a much, much better understanding and much more respect and admiration for humanism than she'd had previously.
Can you talk a little bit more? What do you mean when you say like telling our story? Do you just mean kind of being open about your own life and how humanism has impacted it? Or what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's really a helpful piece of this is that what I focused on, you know, what I focused on when I've spoken to interfaith audiences is, you know, I tell my story and about the fact that, you know, I really just looked at my life and the people around me. I tell the story of myself, you know, growing up in Queens, New York, around people of every different religious background, and just really loving and caring about all my different friends and knowing that we were from all these different religious backgrounds, and just knowing that in my heart that no one of us could possibly be from the one true religion. because, you know, it's just the sense that we were all equal. And telling my story about how I feel like becoming a humanist really honestly made me a better person, because it made me feel this pressure to get my life right in this world. That I used to sort of think to myself when I would have a bad moment, something along the lines of, well, you know, God will forgive me, or, you know, I will have a better time. You know, it's something about the next world, the next life, I'd get another chance. And humanism has really helped me to understand that this is it. This is the one chance we get. And so if we mess it up, that's who we are, and we have to, therefore, really live the best possible life we can. Telling stories about that, I think, really helps people understand who we are, where we're coming from, and the religious audiences that I've spoken to have just, again, they said, you know, I used to think of humanism only as something that was against me, and now I really can put a name and a face on it, and I can realize how many of my friends and my family and my loved ones are humanists. And how, you know, they really now feel a responsibility to work with us and to respect us and to treat us, you know, equally as they would treat themselves.
Okay, so you're seeing that the interfaith community is becoming more accepting of us as humanists mainly. Is it because you're going out and telling these stories, or is it also just because, I mean, have the new atheists helped our cause at all in terms of that, in terms of them understanding even aspects of atheism or humanism that they may not agree with? Or is it more the idea of us kind of going out and telling stories that's made a difference?
I think it's both. I think that some of the new atheism, as it's called, and by the way, it's not that the quote unquote new atheists are themselves adopting that term. And so I use it as a term of convenience, but let's acknowledge, you know, the new atheism, atheism 3.0. I mean, these are terms that get thrown around by the media primarily, but,
exactly.
But I would say that the authors that we're talking about, you know, whether it's Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or what have you, have certainly contributed a lot to raising the visibility of non-theist Americans. They have stood up for their beliefs, and they've made a very forceful case for some of the problems with religion, some of the bad with God that's out there in the world. And I think that that's very important. But my concern is, where do we go from here? Because I think that if we stay at this place where we are not having conversations with religious people, in addition to critiquing what we feel needs to be critiqued, because I would never say that we should stop critiquing what we think needs to be critiqued. But if we just stay at that point and we don't go anywhere from there, I think that we are costing ourselves an opportunity, and we're costing humanity an opportunity to, to work together to improve the world.
How do you feel that your book and kind of these ideas are being received in the movement? Because I know in the past there have kind of been issues with, you know, you've gotten some criticism in terms of your, you know, critique of the so-called new atheists and, you know, the way that you want to approach religious people and kind of your vision for humanism. Are you feeling a lot of that same pushback, or are more people kind of coming along and seeing that, oh, hey, it's one thing to critique religion and, you know, to say bad things about it or whatever, but kind of there's this next step that we have to start focusing on?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's more of the latter. I think that, basically there have been, a lot of really positive responses to the book and, to this kind of approach to humanism within the movement. I visited with the, humanist chaplaincy at Rutgers, for example, and, I'm just delighted with the work that they're doing on campus there to build a positive humanist community. And, you know, they're talking about, using the book as a text for themselves to, you know, to sort of begin the conversation and begin teaching people about humanism. I heard from Bob Behrman at the American Humanist Association, who's, you know, obviously a real leader in humanist education, who, you know, told me that, he thinks the book should be required reading. And again, it's this, you know, it's something that is a helpful tool to introduce people to humanism. I think that, there are people who have concerns, but they tend not to be the people who've actually read the book, or who, you know, might've, you know, read the book, but, you know, they haven't really heard me answer their questions about it. I think that, You know, it's natural and it's understandable that, you know, people who are coming at humanism from a point of view of being, you know, being aware of the wrongs of religion, and they see a title like chaplain, and they know that I'm talking about building community. And, you know, it's natural to understand that they would have some concerns about that. But look, the point about a chaplain, and call me Hey You if you want, you know, nobody needs to call me a chaplain, but that is a title that in this day and age, you know, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, et cetera, hold. And it just means somebody who's serving an institution in a particular kind of role. And, you know, why not a humanist chaplain? Why is it that we have to be in that setting, the one group that's not represented? And, you know, the idea of a community, you know, as I've been saying to people, it's this idea to me that let's acknowledge that religion is a human creation through and through, that people created religion, people created God, people created ritual, people created everything that's associated with religion. And, you know, why wouldn't we imagine that at least some of the things that they created were actually reasonably helpful ideas? Not all of them. And none of these ideas about religion are helpful in every single way or in every single situation. But when you talk about weddings, funerals, baby naming ceremonies, you know, when you talk about gathering a little bit more regularly and having our gatherings maybe take on a little bit more of an aesthetic appeal, you know, the way that when you go to a church, it's a beautiful space. It has art, it has music, these sorts of things. When you talk about that, you know, I think that it's really hard to challenge. I mean, these are things that the American Humanist Association has supported for a long time. These are things that the British Humanist Association is doing an amazing job of doing. They've got the British Humanist Association is a very strong group that has, a lot of enthusiasm around its weddings and funerals and other ceremonies. And it just recently hired a composer to compose music for it, for British humanism. So, you know, these are some of the things that I think we can start to look at a little bit more carefully as we think, how are we going to grow this movement so that we can number, you know, in terms of people who call themselves humanists, not just in the tens of thousands, but in the hundreds of thousands and ultimately in the millions. These are some of the tools in our toolbox.
Yeah. So what are some of the examples of community-based things that you as the humanist chaplain at Harvard are doing on campus?
So we've been really, really busy at Harvard with humanism in the last few years. I think it's funny, we've gotten so busy and we've gotten to the point where we have had so many hundreds and even thousands of people attend our events on a regular basis that we are now getting a lot of attention from the religious groups on campus who are constantly wanting to debate us, to work with us, to have lunch with us, what have you. And, you know, as much as I am not the craziest about debating religious groups, I did have one of my board members say to me, hey, you know, why don't you just have them debate amongst themselves and then you guys can take on the winner? Which, you know, I thought wasn't a bad joke. And also, you know, there's something to be said for this. You know, the idea to me is that we try to have a diversity of activities, because if you look at what religious groups are, they have such a diversity of activities, you know, and there are so many different kinds of religious groups on campus. And, you know, that's what gives them their strength, is their diversity. You know, there are all these different religious groups, but they're all considered Christian. You know, or they're all, you know, there are many different kinds of Jewish groups, but they're all considered Jewish. So my view is that we should have many different kinds of humanist activities, and they all should be considered humanists. So, you know, in addition to doing things like debates, we have a regular meditation group that meets and does meditation from a secular perspective, because we know that there are millions of non-religious people out there who are interested in things like meditation and yoga. And so we give them secular alternatives for that. We have regular discussion groups where people really get to know each other. They become some of each other's best friends. We've had multiple couples from our grad student group that have gotten engaged and married after being part of our group. we do community service outings that we've been really working hard to try to encourage other groups like ours to do around the country. And we focus not just on humanism and science, which is an important topic, of course, and always will be. And, you know, we had a Darwin Day party last year that was probably the biggest Darwin Day celebration in the country, as far as I can tell. We had about 700 people come to our Darwin Day party. We had a symposium for Darwin Day around campus that our goal, and I think we met it, was for every person at Harvard to know that Darwin Day was February 12th this past year. But in addition, we focus on humanism and culture. We've had cultural icons come and speak to us and be part of our community, people like Salman Rushdie, the rock star and evolutionary biologist Greg Graffin of the band Bad Religion. Last year, Joss Whedon, the TV icon, writer, director, producer from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, et cetera. And I won't yet announce who our next winners of the Cultural Humanism Lifetime Achievement Award are going to be. But suffice to say, we're very excited for them.
Are you basically trying to create something that's like a humanist congregation? And do you kind of see that as the wave of the future, or like the next step for where our movement really needs to go?
Well, I think we're creating a humanist center. And we actually, you know, within the next 5 years or so, hope and expect to have a physical humanist center on campus for people to come out to and be a part of. And, you know, congregation might be one word people could use. Some people like that word. Some people don't. You could call it a community. But I think that we are trying to create something that is a lasting institution that people can really look to and take part in, and that can serve and meet many, many, many of their needs. One of the things that I noticed when I was out on the road visiting the Coalitions of Reason, in places like Washington, D.C. and Baltimore and Chicago and New Jersey, et cetera, is that there are all these people. I mean, really, there are millions of people out there who would respond to our message. I mean, people hear something on the radio, they hear it, they read something in the newspaper, and they come out and they're curious. But in so few places are there any people who are well-trained professional leaders who are there to help them organize something for their own community on the ground. What you basically see is you have people out there who have taken on these leadership roles in the Coalitions of Reason and in humanist groups, where they have entire other careers, they have entire other backgrounds. They're professors, they're doctors, they are engineers, they're teachers, they're all sorts of things. They can basically afford to spend maybe 10% of their time on humanist and other kinds of related activities. And, you know, they're doing so much, but there's a limit to what we can expect. And I think until we can put well-trained professional leaders in some of these cities to help people who come along and get interested in all this build something real, something tangible, we're not going to see the humanist movement expand much beyond the present state. And so one of the things that I've been working on at Harvard and that, you know, getting out there and writing this book and talking about it has really helped me to continue to do and to get even more excited about is to begin to train professional leaders. You know, we have this divinity school at Harvard that has long purported itself to be very liberal and to want to train people who are not just Christians in how to serve communities. And so finally, you know, a few years ago, we said, fine, we'll take you up on it. We'll, you know, if it's a bluff, we're going to call the bluff, and we're going to start training humanist leaders here as well. And it's been a real pleasure and an honor for me to work with the first few students in that program. They've been an amazing caliber of people. And I continue to hear from around the country from people who say, you know, I would really love a chance to study for 2 or 3 years and learn about humanism and learn how I can serve the humanist movement professionally. So I hope that as a movement, we can work towards those kinds of goals in the coming years.
So are you saying, like, right now at Harvard, there's something like a Master's of Humanist Studies?
I'm saying that we're working towards that. I'm saying that you, one can do that kind of work right now. But we're trying to get courses specifically on humanism up and running. And That's going to take a little time. It's going to take a little bit of funding. It's not the kind of thing where it's a huge multi-million dollar proposal like it would be if we were trying to get some sort of academic chair funded at Harvard. That would cost $6 million or something along those lines. But, you know, it's going to take some work on behalf of the movement. But I think that, yeah, within the next few years, we could see, a master's at Harvard Divinity School that would allow people to basically study and focus on humanism.
It's very interesting because I know there have been other efforts kind of in terms of like the Humanist Institute and the Institute for Humanist Studies who have been offering courses and all that. But I mean, kind of what you're saying seems like it would really take it to the next level in terms of making it a master's at an Ivy League school and everything.
Yeah. I mean, my vision is to work directly with those groups. As many know, I studied with Sherwin Wine at something called the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism, but I've also spoken closely with members of the faculty and administration of the Humanist Institute, and I think those groups do great work. And my vision would be, you know, when you're doing a master's degree someplace like a Harvard, you get your spring and summer off, and you get lots of opportunities to travel and do research. And so my vision would be that ultimately students who would come here to study with me and to study humanism in general would also spend time studying, whether it was in New York or Washington, D.C. or Michigan, at some of the other humanist educational institutions in our movement, and that we would build them all up together. I think that everyone who's doing humanist education that I know of is doing a great job. Now we need to focus on how we can collaborate more, because the thing about religion is that, say what you will about its theology, but it spends time building up powerful institutions. And so I've never really been so interested in critiquing, even the new atheism so much as I'm saying, in addition to the new atheism, we need something powerful. We need to build up a positive alternative to religion, because if religion adopted the same model of organizing itself that humanists have adopted in the past, where we don't really build institutions and buildings and we don't train leaders very professionally, well, religion would go away immediately. And so we need to make sure we don't go away. We need to make sure that we really invest in our movement and build up something that religious people can turn to us and say, you know, not only do I respect your beliefs, but I see what you're doing in the community, and I respect that too. And I've seen that. So I've seen that happen so many times at Harvard, where, you know, somebody who was sort of religiously on the fence will see the level of activity that we have going on. And maybe they'll hear lately about the community service programs that we're trying to run. And they'll say, you know, that's something that I can really wrap my mind around. That's something that I really want to get involved in. And it's I'm not saying that we're going to convert the religious masses, but I'm saying that we're certainly going to make a lot of people think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there've been small examples of that kind of out in the movement as a whole. I know in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Coalition of Reason has done activities with church groups, kind of, you know, like, I think it's like road cleanup or something to do with feeding the homeless and all that. And those are kind of examples of what you're saying, of working with people in every community. So.
I've written about some of those stories in the book. I mean, I want to make clear, I've been so inspired by the example of a lot of humanists out there around the country. Whether it's the humanists in Philadelphia who are working, you know, to do community service, and they started out doing it alongside Christians rather than wanting to just debate them. The humanists that I met in Tulsa who are leading the Tulsa Interfaith Coalition, which is doing great work, and they're giving great visibility to humanism by leading a group of Christians, Muslims, Jews, and others, or just humanists in so many different parts of the country that are working hard to build concrete projects. That's what I've been the most inspired by. And again, when I think about what we could accomplish if we could all unite under a common banner, if you will, and we don't even need to agree on the name, but I think that if we could agree at least that humanism is a name for this movement that is a powerful name and it's a positive name, and if we could really train professionals to help our thousands of volunteers to do even better work, and if we could really build buildings where we could have addresses for people to go to, I shudder to think what we could accomplish. I said to my friend Eboo Patel, who is an advisor to the White House on faith issues and leads the Interfaith Youth Corps, and welcomes humanists and atheists into his group and his activities. You know, I was talking to him about our efforts to get out and do community service and what have you. And, you know, he's so appreciative of them. But he said, you know, Greg, in most places, if I want to refer a humanist friend around the country to you guys, I don't have an address to send them to. And, you know, I had to agree with him that that's something that now that we are building our movement and now that we are at the point where we can say to people around the country, you cannot afford to be prejudiced against us. You cannot afford to discriminate against us. We will hold you accountable. We will hold your feet to the fire. If you say anything less, then of course we can be good without God. The next step is for us to start to build institutions so that, you know, folks like Ibu, you know, do have addresses that they can refer their people onto, you know, when somebody comes to him, as hundreds of students apparently have, and say, you know, I'm interested in humanism. That's my perspective. When I get involved in interfaith or think about myself as a citizen of the world, I myself am a humanist. But let's build something so that those folks can refer people on and, you know, be able to point to us as a true world tradition in every way.
And so you would say that in that sense, the interfaith movement isn't worried or threatened by humanists at all?
No, I think that they're not. I think that there are some religious people who are threatened by humanism, and even maybe some of them are involved in interfaith work, but they're not really doing interfaith work that's worthy of the name. I think that the major leaders of the major interfaith institutions in this country, whether it's the Interfaith Youth Corps or the Interfaith Alliance or groups like them, are very much willing to work with us, willing to join hands with us, willing to accept us, and even willing to see us as leaders. You know, Roy Speckhart, you know, before he became the executive director of the American Humanist Association, I believe worked for the Interfaith Alliance, and it's a very good organization. And I've gone on the radio shows of these groups, and I've you know, spoken for them at their conferences, and they want to hear from us. They love the idea that we consider ourselves no worse and no better as human beings than anyone else. And they're not afraid of hearing us critique their religious views. What they want to know, and I think that on this, most humanists agree with me, is that we acknowledge that a problem like global warming is not interested in whether we believe in a God or not, right? You know, the ozone layer, the Earth's atmosphere is not sitting around waiting for us to work this debate out. We're either going to figure out a solution for it together, or we're all going to perish. And so in the midst of our theological discussions and debates, can we find the courage and the acceptance to work with one another without having to resolve the debate, without having to say, oh, we're all the same. You know, there's no difference between Judaism, Christianity, and humanism. Of course there's a difference. But can we, in addition, work together? Can we work on economic problems, problems of social justice, you know, problems of trying to figure out how to, you know, how to save ourselves from nuclear proliferation and terrorism, problems that really affect every single human being and that aren't going to sit around waiting for us to work out the religion versus humanism debate. That's the issue. And I do feel very much like we have this opportunity and therefore a responsibility to work with others to solve those problems.
All right. And this actually brings up an interesting point. I remember reading an article or an interview with you from a local Boston newspaper, and you said something. You said, what I'm more concerned about are religious people who'd be fine with humanism and interested in working as equals with me, but have never heard of it. Mm-hmm. When we meet those people, we have to explain, we're not here to erase you. We're here to embrace you.
Yeah.
But now, in a theoretical future, let's say that there's not, you know, very conservative and fundamentalist religious folk have more or less been marginalized, and they only represent a very small segment of society. And the two greater, the more dominant influences are either liberal religionists and people who are interfaith and secular humanists, mm-hmm. religious humanists, you know, atheists, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. our movement.
Sure.
When it comes to if it's just an us versus them type situation, and maybe mm-hmm. it's a bad way to even look at it like that, I mean, don't we as humanists still have an obligation to continue to critique them because we still see them as fundamentally wrong in some of their views? Or well, Jen,
I mean, I don't think we need to wait 50 years to start critiquing religion. I think that we're already doing it, and we should continue to make our critique. Look, people who haven't read Good Without God, I think may not realize that I'm very upfront in, you know, my critique of a lot of traditional religious theology. And I'm very, very upfront about the idea that there's no God and that I'm not interested in any way in praying to a God or anything like that. You know, we have to be very bold about that. It's just a matter of being willing to build coalitions alongside that. The story that I tell is the story of Thomas Jefferson. I think that rather than looking forward 50 years, let's look back to the election of 1800. Because Thomas Jefferson, when he was running for president in 1800, was running against John Adams. And John Adams did this real Karl Rovian campaign against Jefferson, assisted by Alexander Hamilton, where they ran an ad that said, essentially, and you can read the details of it in the book, that you have a choice. They said to their audience, they said to Americans, you have a choice. You can vote for Adams and a president who believes in God, or you can vote for Jefferson. And in all block letters, they said, and no God. And Jefferson won the election, and he never denied Adams's accusations about his religious beliefs. Jefferson never denied that he was the man who later in life took a scissors to the Bible and cut out every miracle story and every contradiction and simply left the Jefferson Bible, which is the story of Jesus as a human mortal philosopher and nothing more. He never denied that he was, as I call him in the book, the first humanist head of state. What he did instead was he said, you know, Adams is trying to take away your religious freedom. He's in league with the reactionary Presbyterians, which were that day's equivalent of today's, say, religious right. And he wants to take away your freedom. And that's not what America should stand for. And so let's get together, the deists and the infidels and the liberal Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Quakers and the Jews and many, many others. And let's vote for religious freedom for all of us, as opposed to reactionary religious indoctrination and extremism. And he won. And this is, I think, what we saw in the election of 2008 as well, where a candidate like Kay Hagan was swift-voted by Liddy Dole, saying that she was in league with humanists and atheists. And she simply came out as a Christian, but she, you know, she was reasonably open about the fact that, yes, she'd worked with Woody Kaplan and other leaders in the humanist and atheist movement. And she won. And Barack Obama won, and he's acknowledged nonbelievers and humanists in almost every one of his major speeches. So, you know, we are now at the point where we should critique religion everywhere and anywhere that we feel it is deserved to be critiqued. But we also need to build coalitions. We also need to acknowledge the full picture. The full picture is religion is a human creation. Human beings, when they create things, my rule is 90% of all things that human beings create are crap. You know, so, you know, 90% of religion may be misguided in many ways, but let's also acknowledge that there are some inventions in religion. There are some concepts in religion that are helpful to people, that help people to live good lives. And, you know, it's not our place to go around with a sword, you know, killing anybody because they, you know, because they're not religious and, you know, humanists and atheists don't do that. So let's just acknowledge the good with the bad. And build our movement while we build up all of humanity as well.
Yeah, and I think that's some of the issue with people who would critique your view is I think they can't look past the idea that you do see some value in ritual or in, you know, kind of like all these ceremonies and doing all these community-focused things. For them, I think they see religion just fully as a bad thing, and they can't understand why you would want to salvage even, you know, 5 or 10% of it.
Well, I mean, and I understand, I think that what we have to acknowledge is that their religion really has hurt millions and millions and millions of people. And when religion hurts people, it hurts them badly. And there's no taking that away. There's no papering that over. And so, you know, you've got to be able to understand. I got to be able to understand some of the anger. It's just a matter of where do we go from here? I try to focus my efforts on wanting the best for the humanist movement and wanting the best for human beings. And I think that takes work. It's not easy to do, but the only alternative that's worse is not doing it. I do talk about a saying, from religion, from Judaism, actually, that I really like, that has nothing to do with God, which is, you know, it's not upon us to finish the work, but neither are we free to desist from the work. And, you know, again, that's something that comes from a traditional Jewish text, but where's the God in that statement? Where's the God in the golden rule, right? The golden rule, do unto others, or that which is hateful to you, don't do unto others. Every tradition has that. And there's no God in it whatsoever. Every religion has a statement like that, and there's no God in it whatsoever. So, you know, why would we think that we couldn't learn from some religious people in the past who'd had some good things to say about humanity that really didn't even have anything to do with God?
All right. I think we're going to have to leave it at that. But in terms of where do we go from here, what are you going to be doing in 2010? Are you going to be doing more touring, or are you working on the sequel for your next book, or what's going on?
You know, I've got some writing plans in the works, but nothing worth discussing yet. I think most importantly for me is to continue building up our community at Harvard. We're just so excited about our plans for a center and our plans to train leaders, and to do what I can on the road and from here to sort of help others in the humanist movement to work on similar projects and just get to that point where we have humanists around the country doing community service regularly, doing, you know, educational programs regularly, programs for families, where we have more weddings and funerals going on that are affecting and helping more and more and more families. You know, I just want to do my part. I'm one local leader, but I'm privileged to be in a place that people for some reason want to pay attention to. And so I'll do what I can. And I look forward to working with so many of the colleagues that I've met around the country on this book tour and helping them.
Great. All right. Now, if people want to learn more about the book or the chaplaincy at Harvard, or if they want to buy the book, where can they go on the internet for that?
So they can go to our website, the website of the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, which is harvardhumanist.org. They can go to the website for the book. That's goodwithoutgod.com. They're the same website at the moment, so it's pretty easy. Harvardhumanist.org or goodwithoutgod.com. They can find me on Facebook if they want to know sort of up-to-the-minute details. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/gepstein. That's G-E-P-S-T-E-I-N. And in terms of the book, you can buy it wherever books are sold, but Amazon's a great place to pick it up.
Great. Yeah. Well, good luck with everything in the future. And Greg Epstein, thanks a lot for talking with Humanist Network News.
Thank you so much, Shanda. I'm so grateful to everybody for their enthusiasm and support. And I'm proud to be part of this movement and to be working with the American Humanist Association. Show me a headstone, like a river in sway.
And that was my interview with Greg Epstein, the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. So, Jess, what'd you think of it?
I liked what he said, what Greg said about let's get past our differences of religion or non-religion, and let's focus on those aspects of our world that affect all humans, you know, like our global warming and in any sort of racial or other social justice issue that already transcends religion boundaries. So how can we get past what we don't believe in or what our differences are to make all of those things better?
I thought it was interesting because I was out of the country for a while when all this original stuff came out about Greg versus like the new atheists and everything. But I've read his book, and talking to him, I think he makes it very clear that it is okay to critique religion and that it is okay to kind of discuss those issues, which I admittedly, even though I did read his book and I did get that feel from the book, it was a little surprising for me to hear him be so direct about it. And I think that's one of the things. There's definitely that misconception out there within the humanist movement about exactly where Greg stands when it comes to that issue and where he's coming from, when it's just like, it's not that he's against critiquing religion or anything like that, but his focus is simply more on the on the idea of building up humanist communities, which is good, because I think that there's, you know, him on one side doing that, and then there's this so-called new atheists, the four horsemen of the apocalypse,
right,
who are doing the other stuff. I really hate that term, the new atheists, and calling them the four horsemen of the apocalypse, because I think it's very much a media creation. All the articles and issues about the so-called divides within our movement, I mean, there have been differences in the past, are differences now, and there will always be differences in the future, but
sure,
it's kind of the nature of our movement, and it's really not to the point where some of these articles in like USA Today or whatever, you know, even New York Times, the movement's been getting some more coverage recently, but the media kind of frames it in this battle that we're having to for the future of the movement, which I think really doesn't exist, because I think the movement's always been broad enough that there's certain types of people who want to focus more on building communities, whether, you know, you call it humanist or atheist or bright or whatever.
Right.
And there are those who want to focus more on critiquing religion and attacking and kind of showing, you know, the importance of science and how it can explain everything. And both sides are perfectly fine. And although there's always kind of some skirmishes in terms of what should our focus be, I mean.
Right. Well, to me, it's like you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
You have to have a space to have those debates, which is, and then you also have to have something to do when you gather. So
yeah,
it's kind of like they kind of go hand in hand.
Exactly. I think if the Four Horsemen, if like, you know, Christopher Hitchens and
let's go over that. The Four Horsemen is Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris,
Daniel Dennett.
That's right.
And I think the four of them, and P.Z. Myers has kind of been now the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, apparently.
Yes.
But I think if all of them really sat down and talked with Greg, and if they'd had a long conversation together, I think in the end, whatever differences they have will still pale in comparison. I think that's the whole thing with our movement as a whole. The differences that we all have, no matter if you're ethical culture or, you know, hardcore atheist or humanist or religious humanist or secular humanist or whatever you want to call it, we do have differences, but everything that we actually do have in common, especially I think in comparison to religious people, I think we always have a lot more in common than
right,
we realize. But it's
right,
easier for us to focus on those differences, on kind of the nitpicky issue of exactly what should we call ourselves and exactly how should we, what kind of tactics should we have to kind
yes,
of go up against religious people.
The funny thing is, that's what Greg's saying about existing in society in general as a movement.
Right.
Right? Let's not focus on our differences. Let's focus on what we have in common and figure out what we need to do in order to change, you know, for the better, those things that affect all of us.
Exactly.
So that's kind of funny to me.
So I think the goal for this holiday season and beyond, Jess, can be summed up in four words.
And what are those words, Jinda?
That would be critique religion, celebrate humanity.
Nice. And perhaps one way which you could accomplish both of those things would be to purchase Good Without God and give it to a friend as a gift during this post-holiday season. You can buy Greg Epstein's book, Good Without God, from Amazon.com, and you can find that link on our website at humanistpodcast.org. That's a shorter URL. We're here for you, people. We're trying to make your life easier. Humanistpodcast.org, and you will see show notes from our previous episodes. You can also listen to all of our previous episodes, and you can find any information, any links that we might have mentioned on our show. So humanistpodcast.org. Buy Greg Epstein's book, Good Without God.
And for the weeks that we aren't on air, you can check out the Humanist Network News e-zine, which is at humanistnetworknews.org.
And in closing, folks, we want to hear how you celebrated this winter season. We want to hear what you did, what holiday you celebrated, how you celebrated it, if it was human light, if it was Festivus, if it was solstice. What else, Jinda? Kwanzaa?
Hanukkah. You celebrated all of them. Your birthday.
Christmas, my birthday, yes.
We need to hear how people celebrated your birthday.
Absolutely. What did you do on December 29th? That's what I want to hear. You can send us a letter to the editor or a letter to the producer at hnn@americanhumanist.org. We hope to hear from you, and we hope that you have a wonderful holiday season.
Yes, we do. Thanks for listening to Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jinda Huang.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. And we'll see you in 2010, folks.
Show me a head start, like a river in swing.